Okay, so yesterday I showed you that actually basically based on the idea of Einstein's elevator, or actually, you know, its slightly modified version, which is that of the freely falling frame, we can introduce quantities such as curve metric or a geodesic equation. So our approach was, we start with with the physics which is known in this freely falling frame. It's just the special relativity. And then we perform a general coordinate transformation on these things. And that gave us the formula for the curve metric. And that gave us a formula for the monster, which we called Christoffel symbol. But anyway, so the resulting formulas are super simple. So if you want to go from the Minkowski metric to the curve metric, you just write, instead of eta mu nu, you just write g mu nu, which will be a symmetric metric. Symmetric matrix, 4x4 matrix, and it will have 10 components. And these components, in principle, can depend on the coordinates x mu. Okay, so that's our curve metric. And then we derive the geodesic equation, just starting from the equation in flat space and, you know, doing this general coordinate transformation. And we had some monster gamma, which is nothing else than the Christoffel symbol. And it can be written in terms of this curve metric in this nice form. So, of course, it's not. It would be useful to have a concrete example of what we are doing here. So I will do today the example, which is like the canonical example of a nice frame which you get by a coordinate transformation, and that's of the Rindler frame. And you will use it in your homework, but we will also use it to actually discuss black holes and stuff like that.
I don't know. I don't like too much the way we did use equations, because I think that we are using like the equivalence principle, and we are going from an inertial frame of reference to, we are saying that this inertial frame of reference is locally like a gravitational field, and then I think that in that way we can relate coordinates from curved spaces and inertial frames of reference. But then this is not a general.
Of course not. I will mention that in a minute. Thank you for that. Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So wait 20 minutes and we will get there, okay? So an example. I think it's very useful to have an example of what, you know, what we are talking about, how the curve metric can look like, and, you know, what we can get by the coordinate transformation. So example here, and that will be that of the Rindler frame. And so basically, what we are trying to do now is that we want to describe physics in Minkowski space from a point of view of an observer who is uniformly accelerating. Okay, so Rindler frame will be a frame which is associated with uniformly accelerated observer. So the first question, of course, is what is the trajectory of this uniformly accelerated observer in the Minkowski space? So uniformly accelerated observer and you will basically prove this in your homework. So if you have uniformly accelerated observer, meaning an observer who is actually subject to a constant force for all times, then we shall see that this has sweeps the following trajectory in Minkowski space, which is given by, well, okay, so we have Minkowski space, which has coordinates small t and small x and whatever. And so then this small t is given by 1 over a, which is a constant, sine h a times tau, where tau is the proper time of the observer. And then x is 1 over a cosine h of the same thing, a tau. So tau is the proper time of the observer. And a is a constant, and of course it better be related to this constant acceleration, and it is indeed so. So if I introduce an acceleration a mu, so we are in Minkowski space, in flat space, so we just take d u mu over d tau, so just the standard derivative as we know it, we are in flat space. So this is my four velocity, I just divide four velocity by d tau, that's the four acceleration. And then you take the magnitude of this acceleration, and you call it a. So this is precisely what it is. Eta mu nu, a mu, a nu. Okay, and that will be a constant. So now we are really imposing that the magnitude of the four acceleration is a constant, and so our observer moves on this. Okay, so that's the trajectory, and of course how the trajectory looks like is super simple. So we have our Minkowski frame, which is t and x. And of course we have y and z as well, but they will not play any role, so I will just suppress them at this point. Okay, and so the observer, what basically is doing is that the observer starts at infinity, and it moves super fast there at the speed of light, and then it comes, you know, come closer and closer to the origin of the coordinates and is decelerating uniformly with this deceleration a. And then it comes to a finite distance from the origin where he stops, and then it goes back to infinity with a uniform acceleration. So then, of course, what this corresponds to is that if I draw the 45-degree light cone here, then the trajectory is simply a hyperbola, like sort of asymptotes. So this thing here, and so you know, if you are infinitely for an infinite time, I just basically travel at the speed of light, I approach this 45-degree line, and then infinitely past, I approach the speed of light, but the opposite direction. So this is the trajectory of the observer, and that's our x mu of tau, but x mu is of course t of tau and x of tau. Okay, so that's our uniformly accelerated observer. All right, and so that's how that observer looks from a point of view of a guy who is actually, you know, Minkowski standing here. But now you may be asking, how does the space-time look like from the point of view of the observer, of the accelerated observer? Okay, so now let us introduce some coordinate system, some nice coordinate system, which this observer could associate with himself. And then let's see, you know, what that observer sees. Okay, so now let's introduce a coordinate system associated with this observer. And of course, you know, if you're trying to associate a coordinate system with this, you know, with the observer, of course the observer wants to look privileged in that coordinate system. So basically what we are looking for is a coordinate system where the observer is located, let's say, in the origin all the time. So I'll introduce new position capital X and new time capital T. And so if this is to be associated with that observer, let's place the observer in the origin, so he will be all the time at capital X equal to zero. And also the capital T will actually coincide with his proper time when he's describing his own trajectory. So basically capital T will be his proper time, and capital X equal to zero is his position for all the times. Okay, and so one such system is described by the Rindler coordinates. So Rindler coordinates. And so let's call them T and X, capital T and capital X. And so they are And so then you want to find how these Rindler coordinates are related to our Minkowski coordinates. And so they are simply given by, so the small Minkowski t is given by 1 over a plus capital X sine h a capital T, and small x is 1 over a plus capital X cosine h a t. So now you see that if I, okay, so that's the transformation between the Minkowski coordinates, small t and small x, and the Rindler coordinates, which the observer is using, capital X and capital T. So this is the capital X, and this is the capital X here. So now you immediately see is that indeed, if I take capital X to be equal to zero, so this disappears, then I just have 1 over a sine h a t, and if I and then it precisely coincides with this thing here. So capital X will describe my trajectory, and tau is precisely the capital time t for that observer. So the observer is really distinguished in these coordinates, and it's always like X is equal to zero, and capital T equals to tau. So T is actually has the meaning of proper time of this observer. All right, so we have the coordinate transformation. And so we have some new coordinate system, T and capital T and capital X. And we may be asking, you know, how does the spacetime look like in this coordinate system? And so one thing which you can immediately, you know, sort of analyze from this transformation is, so let's find the curve metric first. Okay, so how do we find the curve metric? We start from the flat metric. Okay, so now first let's find the curve metric. And then we had a formula which was basically the chain rule, but it's always better to do it explicitly. So our original Minkowski metric was just d s square is minus dt square plus dx square, which are the small quantities here. And then plus dy square and dz square, which are not important. Okay, and so then what you want to do is that, of course, I want to write this in terms of the new coordinates. So I simply write that dt is actually dt over d capital T plus dt over d capital X, and the same thing for dx. So it's d small x dt dt plus d small x d capital X dx. So this is what I have to do. Of course, I have to calculate it explicitly. But you can do that, right? So I have the explicit expressions, how t and x look like. And so I can calculate what these guys really are. OK, and then I have to just square that. I will have dt square. So I square this thing here. And then I square dx square. And I get something. The trick is that, of course, you get something which is still written in terms of the old coordinates, small t and small x. So you need to express the finally in terms of capital X and capital T. OK, so I'll leave that as your homework. But in the end, what you get is a simple result. You just find that the metric now looks like this in terms of the new coordinates dt square and dx square. So that's our curved metric. And so that's the first example of a curved metric. And you see that indeed, going from a Minkowski metric where it's minus 1 and plus 1 standing here, now I have something more complicated, which in principle depends on the coordinates. Okay, so now minus 1 becomes 1 plus ax square, and then I still have a plus one here. Okay, so metric is now more complicated, and of course it's the effect of the coordinate transformation or the effect of gravity, if you want. All right, so we have this and we have that. So now we may be asking, you know, what part or, you know, what this observer, what these coordinates, how they look like, how they actually relate to the old coordinates, small t and small x. And just looking at these expressions over there, and so we have t, we have x, and we have the important 45 degree lines. So one immediate consequence of this metric, if you look at here, is that notice that something strange is happening when ax is equal to minus 1. So when ax is equal to minus 1, the whole thing here vanishes. But if the whole thing vanishes, the metric becomes now degenerate. Okay, we only move in dx direction, but we don't move in dt direction. So in order the metric will be, in order the metric is non-degenerate everywhere, I have to actually restrict myself to a certain range of coordinates. Okay, so in order metric is non-degenerate, we have to restrict to a range of coordinates. We have to restrict the range of coordinates so of course you know there's no problems with capital T so I can take T capital T freely to be from minus infinity to infinity so that's fine so T goes from minus infinity to plus infinity, there is no problem there. But for x, I have to decide. I am above ax minus 1 or below ax minus 1. So you have to make a choice. The metric will be fine in either case, but it's not fine when ax equals to minus 1. So I have to decide either go this range or that range. Okay, so let me choose the range where I will have x positive. So x now can depend from minus 1 over a and then infinity, in which case I'm avoiding this minus 1. Okay, and so that's the restriction I have to do. Okay, so these are my ranges of coordinates. And you can simply, you know, get them by looking at the metric here. Okay, so now it's obvious that if I have x belonging to that range, okay, so t goes from minus infinity to infinity because sine h can be positive or negative. But small x, because cosine h is always positive, and this has to be positive because we just decided it will be positive, small x has to be positive. Okay, in other words, my coordinates at most cover half of the plane. Not the whole Minkowski plane, but half of the plane. In fact, if you do the analysis more carefully, then you see that basically if you take the ratio t over x, then you get something like tangens or whatever. So you can at most get to these 45 degrees lines. So in fact, what actually, if you do the analysis looking at the coordinate transformations more carefully, only this part of the spacetime, of the original Minkowski spacetime, is actually covered. So this one here. Okay. Everything else is actually excluded by this choice of yeah.
But like I get how the coordinates kind of be extended into the light cone, but there's also this like the picture of it only covering the right side seems to me like an artifact of the fact that we do draw only a two-dimensional picture. Like if we added another spatial dimension, then in two dimensions, the two Rindler wedges are like separate, are disconnected. But if we add another dimension, then you can rotate phi to get from the right side into the left side, right? Because we have rho and phi.
That's right. You have rho and phi, so it's called boost rotation space time. Yeah, yeah. But stay. Yeah.
So you can go to the left side with the Rindler coordinate phi, right? Even if we restrict x to being in that.
No, that's not true. Because what I'm doing here is I'm preferring the x direction, right? So my particle really moves in the x direction. So there will be a cone around that particle, like that, and that will be only specified to that cone. So it has to be cylindrically symmetric with respect to my trajectory of the particle, and I'm choosing my trajectory to be in the x direction. Okay, think about it. Anyway, so in this two-dimensional picture is obvious, and in the high-dimensional picture is also, also true. Okay, so now we only cover this part of the Minkowski diagram. Okay, so now you may be plotting, you know, what these coordinates cover. So we already know that the trajectory of the observer, so this is our observer, and that simply corresponds to x equals to zero. Okay, so now it's not so surprising that if I, for example, want to find what x positive looks like, you will find another hyperbola. So this will be x equals to constant, which is bigger than zero. And then you can find how it looks for x negative, but I cannot go too negative. I will actually have to stop at minus 1 over a. So then it will be another hyperbola. And that will be for x equal to constant is now negative. If I push this to the very limit, x equals to minus 1 over a, I actually find this line. Okay. So this is, if you want, x equal to minus 1 over a. Then I may be asking how capital T equal to constant lines look like. Well, so if I take small t equal to 0, then I better get 0. Well, this is not 0, so I better get 0 here. So it's actually for capital T equal to 0. So this line here, which of course corresponds to small t equal to 0, it also corresponds to capital T equal to 0. Okay, so finally more analysis. You will find that t equal to constant lines are just straight lines. So this will be t is smaller than 0, t equal to constant smaller than 0, and this will be t equal to constant bigger than 0. Okay, so these are the coordinates of this new observer. This is our privileged line where the observer sits. And you know, these coordinates only cover one quarter of the original Minkowski space. And this is how they cover it. Okay, so now what is almost immediate is that, of course, we are still in Minkowski space. Right, so there is no funny business about light rays and stuff like that. So the light still propagates under 45 degrees. So our light cones, are still those of the Minkowski space. Okay, so I'll plot it three-dimensional, but of course it's only two-dimensional here. Light still travels 45 degrees. Okay, that has a far-reaching consequence. Well, the far-reaching consequence is not only that the observer cannot actually go to the other parts of the Minkowski space. He always stays here in this one quarter of the space. But also, he cannot see what's happening behind this line. So if I have something happening here, you know, the signal will travel under 45 degrees at most. Okay, so it will travel under 45 degrees. But this observer, with sort of asymptotes to this line, will never see it. Okay, so similarly for the object here, the only thing which he can see is actually what happens here, and he will see it at infinite time. So he can only see things which are happening, you know, below this line. So what it means is that this will be a horizon. So this is a horizon. And so simply the horizon is shielding from the observer everything what is happening up here.
So the cone is horizontal, right?
Sorry, what is?
The cone is horizontal.
The cone is horizontal. Which cone?
I'm just thinking that this diagram probably just confused. I'm thinking that this diagram is like a light cone that is horizontal.
No, light cone if I plot it in Minkowski coordinates, right, it looks like this. In the coordinates capital T and X, okay, no, this is the light cone, right? All right. But similarly, notice that, you know, if I am in this region, well, the observer can see things coming from this region, okay? So things can come from this region, but the observer cannot send things into that region, right? So I can send, let's say, if I am here, I can at most send things up here, and so I can send them here, but I'll never be able to do it this way, right? Because I would have to propagate outside of the light cone.
Yeah, that's
right.
Saying that the light cone is in horizontal position, so the light cone is like instead of being here.
I'm not sure. Okay, let's discuss afterwards. Okay, so what it means is that there is also a horizon here, but this horizon is slightly different from this one. So this horizon tells me I cannot send signals into here, and so that's called a past horizon. And this horizon tells me I cannot receive signals from what's happening here, and so that's the future horizon. Okay, so you see, as another consequence of the equivalence principle, it's actually prediction of horizon, so something funny happening in the space-time for certain observers. Okay, so this is, so the existence of horizons is consequence number four, consequence of the equivalence principle of the Einstein elevator number four, is the existence of horizons for certain observers. So in other words, you know, certain parts of the whole space-time suddenly become inaccessible, you know, for what the observer can see or where the observer can send signal. Okay. So now why this is super interesting example is that we will see that this is precisely what happens in the black hole space-time. So basically you can understand all black hole physics by just discussing the Rindler space-time. So this is the Rindler, as we are just discussing now. But if you have a black hole space-time, the picture is exactly the same. So you use some kind of coordinates. In these coordinates, you have an observer who sort of sits here outside that. So that's our observer who hovers above the black hole, you know, sits in his rocket or her rocket above black hole. So now you have a horizon here again, which is precisely like this horizon here. And you have another horizon there, which is precisely like that horizon here. Okay, so I can send signals inside. Okay, I cannot send signals here. I can receive signals from here. I cannot receive signals from there. Okay, so the only difference is that, of course, if you look at, if you are clever and stop accelerating, you are again a Minkowski observer. And so you see what's happening here, and there's nothing strange happening here. There's just a Minkowski space. What happens here, if you stop accelerating, actually you will find that there is a hidden singularity, and so there's a black hole with its singularity. So that's the only difference, is that if you cross that horizon, there is no flat space, but there's something strange happening there. But otherwise, the physics is exactly the same. Okay, so now we understand black holes. And of course, you know, this is a far-reaching consequence. So basically, let me try to convince you that whatever you want to know about black holes is sort of already captured in this super simple setup. I just start accelerating. And so one example of this is if you take the quantum effects into account, then what you'll find is that an accelerated observer, despite that he is in Minkowski space, he doesn't see Minkowski vacuum. He sees a vacuum which is filled with radiation, which is a blackbody radiation of a given temperature. And so this observer will actually see a temperature let's distinguish from capital T coordinate, which is given by a over 2 pi, where a is our acceleration. So this guy, when he's accelerating with this acceleration a, he will see a temperature like that. So an accelerated observer, sees black body radiation, with this temperature. And of course, this is simply an effect of him being accelerated. Okay? And so, okay. Well, if this observer sees a temperature, this observer better see a temperature as well. Okay, so then you can immediately conclude that this observer also see a temperature. And so this temperature is now given by, okay, let's write it, a surface gravity divided by 2 pi. So black hole actually will radiate as well. An observer at infinity will see something which is given by the acceleration of the horizon divided by 2 pi. So what this is a surface gravity, and it's basically really a gravitational acceleration on the horizon of the black hole. So if you want to stay on the horizon of the black hole, you have to be accelerating super fast. Okay? So it's an infinite acceleration you actually need in order to stay on the horizon of the black hole. But then, if you go to infinity, there's a gravitational redshift. And if you gravitational redshift this acceleration, you get a finite value of this acceleration at infinity. That's precisely this value here. Okay, so the observer in the black hole spacetime will see a black body radiation with this temperature. Okay, so you see these analogies go really, really far. And basically, all you need to know about black hole physics is already here. Okay? Questions?
Can you go about the temperature because of the black hole, or is it because like you are accelerating faster?
So this is a Hawking radiation. So here the black body radiation is just because I'm accelerating. Here it's sort of a non-local effect because I have to go to infinity to see this temperature really. Of course, if I'm closer to the black hole, I would see a bigger temperature. If I'm exactly at sitting on the horizon, I would see an infinite temperature, but otherwise basically the same thing. Okay. Of course, you know, this thing was known first. It is the famous Hawking's paper, Hawking radiation. However, the derivation is completely wrong. And it doesn't, you know, nobody believed that it's actually correct. And so then, you know, basically there's a new derivation of this due to Unruh. And so this is called an Unruh effect. And so because of this analogy, you know, and the derivation of this thing is, you know, waterproof. So now people believe in this. So that's why they believe in that as well. All right. Very good. So this was an example of a gravitational field simply produced by going to an accelerated frame. Okay. Yes.
Do the measurements of black holes that have been recently made like allow us to measure that?
Okay. So of course nobody measured this yet. The reason is that, okay, so the temperature is bigger for smaller black holes. Unfortunately, we have astrophysical black holes, which are quite big. So the temperature produced by astrophysical black holes is teeny tiny, and it's much smaller than the temperature of the cosmic microwave background and stuff like that. So nobody can actually really directly measure these things yet. There was an exciting possibility is that, you know, people are colliding protons in the collider, and maybe, you know, this wouldn't really work. But anyway, so if you had sufficient number of higher dimensions present, then actually you would form a black hole. the cross section would be sufficiently high to form a black hole. And then this black hole would be teeny tiny. If it's teeny tiny, the temperature is huge. So what you would actually observe is this, you know, burst of the particles, black body radiation, you know, formed in this new small black hole. And so that was a hope that people would see Hawking radiation, for example, there. But of course, they haven't seen it because people probably don't have enough dimensions to actually for the cross section to create the black hole to be sufficiently big. Okay, so people haven't measured this. What they can measure is Hawking temperature for analog systems. So you can actually mimic black holes by some condensed matter systems or waves in water and stuff like that. Again, Andrew is the first person to actually say that there may be some analog systems where I can measure this Hawking radiation. People did measure that. Then people argue maybe this is not exactly Hawking radiation, but what actually Andrew is trying to argue is that this is a purely kinematic effect, that you really don't need Einstein equations to come into place, but rather you need just kinematic things, like you need existence of horizons and stuff like that, which you can certainly mimic in these analog systems. So I think it's a proof that the Hawking radiation actually exists, and it behaves precisely as predicted by these formulas.
Just now you mentioned we have to travel to infinity to observe the temperature.
So very good. So this temperature would be a temperature for an observer who sits at infinity. Okay, this precisely corresponds to redshifting the surface gravity all the way to infinity. If you were sitting closer, you would see a higher temperature.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So I said too much. So what is now very important? So we have this exact nice example where we can do gravity by simply mimicking the gravity with the coordinate transformations. So now, as you mentioned, this is actually not the whole story. So not every gravitational field can be mimicked by a coordinate transformation. And such gravitational fields which cannot be are called true gravitational fields. So par d, let's say true gravitational field and when we were mimicking gravity with this for example the homogeneous gravitational field, we could get rid of gravity by going to a freely falling frame. However, this will not be possible for true gravitational field everywhere. So general gravitational field, it can be time varying and it can be inhomogeneous and time varying and whatever varying, cannot be fully mimicked by acceleration apart from a point, except at a point. Okay, so what I mean by that, let me just draw a picture for you. Okay, so let's say that we have true gravitational field, which is not homogeneous, as we were assuming before, for example, that of the Earth. So let's make Earth super small. This is our Earth. Okay. And that's the origin of gravitational field for us. And let's use Einstein elevator. But let's make the elevator super big. Okay, so now this is our elevator. This is our Einstein's elevator. Let's assume we can. It'll cost lots of money. but then, of course, from Newton that the gravitational field produced by Earth is actually spherically symmetric. So the force will actually go spherically symmetrically. So there will be a force like this. There will be a force like that. There will be a force like that. So now it's obvious that if I had a super big observer in this super big elevator, then this observer sees the effects of gravity. Because if he releases a particle here, it will go to the center of the elevator. If he releases it here, it just goes down. If he releases it there, it goes again to the center of the elevator. So such an observer inside this huge elevator would actually tell, well, there is a gravitational field, and that would be even if the elevator starts falling. Because then simply what you will see as a motion is that this particle goes here, this just stays where it is, and this particle goes here if you just let the elevators start, you know, freely falling. Okay, so this observer will not be able to get rid of gravity completely, and he will know there is a gravitational source of the gravitational field outside. Okay, but of course, if I start making the elevator smaller and smaller, I can make this effect go away, right? If I make now an elevator like this, the effect will be smaller, and if I make the elevator like that, it will be smaller, and if I make the elevator super small, then I will just see the force down. I can start freely falling, and everything will be falling down, and there will be no effect of gravitational field whatsoever. Okay, so can get rid of gravity if elevator super small. That means at a point. So only at a point I can actually get rid of the gravity by going to a freely falling frame. Okay, and so that's why I call the, you know, freely falling frame a local inertial frame. Because, you know, if you are trying to make the inertial frame too big, you will not get rid of the gravity completely, right? I just have to have, you know, super local, super small elevator, and then I can get rid of the gravity. So that's why the inertial frame is only local. So inertial freely falling frame shall freely falling frame is only local. Okay? And that's very important. So I can get rid of gravity by going to a freely falling frame, but only locally at a point. Okay, so this is how the true gravitational fields actually how they behave. So if you had a homogeneous field, then you could get rid of that in the whole elevator. So that field I would call a false gravitational field. In fact, what it is basically just an acceleration. It's an inertial force. However, if you have true gravitational field, you have these strange things happening. Do you know how these strange things are called?
Tidal forces.
So this is what the effect of tidal forces, effect of tidal forces. And of course, that's the characteristic of the true gravitational field. So true gravity is described by tidal forces, or captured by tidal forces, So if you have homogeneous gravitational field, it's not really a true gravitational field in this sense, rather it's a false gravitational field. Okay, so now what is true about true gravity is that I cannot now actually find a global inertial system where my thing would look like in Minkowski frame. So now here we cannot do a coordinate transformation to Minkowski frame to Minkowski frame. Frame everywhere. So meaning, so we can always do it at a point, but we cannot do it everywhere. And so it will not be true that your metric, the curve metric, is written like this. So this is, this was our prescription. It was dxi mu, oh, dxi alpha, dx mu, dxi beta, dx nu, eta alpha beta. So this was our prescription for, you know, if we started with the flat metric in, you know, this freely falling frame, we did a coordinate transformation to some general curve coordinates x mu. This was our curve metric. So this is only a characteristic of false gravitational fields, or fake gravitational fields, characteristic of fake gravitational field. And the true gravitational field will not be like that. It will not be possible to find a coordinate transformation which brings your metric, curve metric, to the flat space. Okay, so that's very important to understand, and this is what you told us at the beginning of the lecture.
The temperature is right by something, and then we can have an idea of how is the metric in any point in space, right?
So how the metric is?
Yeah,
so you can
manifold, you can determine.
You can always introduce a local inertia frame, so I can always introduce Xi alpha here, coordinates Xi alpha. And so in a very small neighborhood of that point, this will be a Minkowski frame. This will be a Minkowski thing. But if I go further away, I will not be able to use the same coordinates. And I will have to use, I can use this point, take a new coordinate system, which will be freely falling here, so this way. And then in the neighborhood of that, I will have Minkowski metric, but I will not have Minkowski metric everywhere. Okay, so characteristic of a fake gravitational field, and this is not possible in general. Okay. So, very good. So this is very, very important, you know, thing to realize. But so now, do we have to throw away everything what we just learned last, you know, last lecture? And the answer is no. So everything about the true gravitational fields, what is written over there, what we learned yesterday, is still true. Okay, so the true gravitational fields still described by the metric element, which is given by g mu nu dx mu dx nu. But now this g mu nu is simply a general metric. Okay, so g mu nu here is simply a general symmetric 4x4 matrix. And if I take it, and it will definitely not always be the case that I can transform it into flat space. But if I take it as a general matrix, this will be true. So similarly, this equation remains true for any matrix. Of course, the Christoffel symbols will not be given by a transformation from flat coordinates, as we have written last time. But they will be still given in terms of this formula here. So everything what is written here remains true for any gravitational field. Okay. And so what we can conclude, and what certainly is true in Einstein's theory of gravity, is that everything you need to know about gravity, about gravitational field, is simply captured by this curved metric here. So gravitational field, fake or not, is simply given by the geometry, meaning by the metric. And so that's a correct statement. But now the metric is just a general metric. Questions? So now just a warning. Of course, gravity is a gauge theory. So what it means is there will be a freedom in the metric, which will have no physical effects. So that freedom is the freedom of doing coordinate transformations. So if I do a coordinate transformation, I am not really changing the true gravitational field. So if the true gravitational field really is described by tidal forces, you know, these tidal forces better be invariant with respect to my coordinate transformations. So tidal forces are described by certain properties of the Riemann tensor. So Riemann tensor is something which you can write down out of the metric, and that will be the true observable physical quantity. Okay, so just a warning, not, you know, if you see two different metrics, it doesn't mean that the space-time actually is different. You know, they may be related by coordinate transformations, and then the true gravitational effects will actually be the same. Okay, as we shall see later. But for this, of course, we need to introduce what the Riemann tensor is and, well, you know, what to do. So we need to study some geometry, which we will start hopefully today, maybe not. Okay, so just to have that in mind. Very good. So now let me just tell you where we are heading and what we want to actually really achieve in the remainder of the course. So we want to construct this theory of gravity for the true gravitational fields, and we want to see, you know, what is the corresponding field theory for these gravitational fields. So a few remarks is, so this was which part? It was D, maybe?
Yeah.
D. So let's do E. E. So search for field theory for gravity. All right, and let me just do it by analogy. So there is a nice field theory, which is the Maxwell theory, and there's another nice field theory, which is the Newton's theory. Okay, so we know these two theories, so let's search, you know, let's learn from them and search for what we need to do for gravity. So let me just do this very nice table here, which is part of one of your questions, so you better pay attention here. So we will have three theories. We will have the Maxwell theory here, Maxwell, and then we'll have the scalar field theory, or which is the Newton one. Newton. And then finally, we are looking for Einstein's theory of gravity. Einstein. Okay, so that's the three field theories, which are the cornerstone of modern physics. And so, of course, you start writing a field theory by saying what the field is. Okay, so the first thing which you need to tell your students, if you want to start discussing the field theories, what is the corresponding field? So the field for Maxwell is what?
A mu,
perfect. So it's the vector potentials A mu. The field for Newton?
Phi.
Phi Newton, perfect. Phi Newton. The field for Einstein, we already know, is the metric, okay? So that's our field, G mu nu, which I hopefully was trying to convince you that that's the thing which you need to know. Of course, if you describe theories beyond Einstein, you may have other fields present. So you may have, for example, torsion field. However, in Einstein theory, gravity is simply described by one tensor, which is the metric. All right, so we have field. Then, you know, given that we already know what the field configuration is, we want to find the equations of motion for the matter. Okay, so the next thing is equations of motion. So by the way, let me just put stars when it is a gauge theory, so not all the fields here are actually physical. Of course, this is just a scalar, so that's fine. But this will be also a gauge theory, so not all the components of the metric actually are physical. Okay.
Isn't the translation invariance gauge?
Translation invariance.
I mean, if I change.
Well, if you have, okay, if you are in flat space, you have translational invariance. In curved space, it will not be true. Okay, yeah. Okay, equations of motion. What are the equations of motion here?
Isn't phi Newton invariant under adding divergentless fields?
Is it?
I mean, the important part is force, right? So, which is the gradient of phi. So if I
I can certainly add a constant to phi Newton, and that will be the freedom. But I cannot really. But constant is too small to really. Right. So here you are asking, can I change a function? No. Okay. It's not a gauge theory. It's certainly a true statement. Okay. So the equation of motion is the Lorentz force here. So dp mu over d tau equals to e f mu nu.
Oh, equation of motion of the particle.
U nu. That's right. Yeah. That's how the matter, the charge matter, moves under influence of the field. So finally. Okay, very good. Do we know what is the corresponding equation of motion in the Newton case?
dp dt equals grad phi.
Uh-huh, exactly. So dp dt is minus gradient of phi. Do we know what it is for Einstein?
It's
the geodesic equation. Let me write it more confusingly. Let me write it in terms of the momentum p. Okay. So it's dp mu over d tau plus gamma mu alpha beta d alpha u beta equals to 0. So you see, we know two things about the Einstein theory already. So finally, the final step to formulate the field theory is to write down the equations of motion for the field. So the field equations. Okay, so that's the final thing that you need to write down. Field equations. Okay, so what are the field equations for Maxwell?
Maxwell equations.
Exactly. So let me write them, for example, this way. 4 pi d mu, d mu. A mu equals to 0. So that's one form of the Maxwell equations, but you have many other forms of Maxwell equations. OK. What are the field equations for Newton? Uh-huh. So by the way, this is Newton here. So then there is a Laplace or Nabla square on phi Newton is 4 pi g rho matter. Okay, so very good. And that's, you know, these three things really, they specify the Maxwell theory. These three things, they specify the Newton's theory. So we will be done with our theory of gravitational field if we can actually find the field equations for Einstein. Okay, so that will be the task for us. And so for that, you will need to do some work. So similar to Einstein, when he was trying to formulate his field equations, he will have to learn some differential geometry. So of course, at the time of Einstein, differential geometry was not really a part of curriculum for a physicist. So actually, physicists didn't know about differential geometry. And he had to painfully learn it on his own, actually with the help of his friend, Marcel Grossmann, who was a mathematician. OK, so it took Einstein a couple of years to learn differential geometry. We will do it in three lectures. But that's what we have to do. Okay, so for this, you need to learn differential geometry. Okay, very good. So let me use that tiny piece of the blackboard which we have here to actually give you the answer. So a spoiler. And this spoiler is actually how Einstein basically arrived at his field equations. So basically, that's what took him so long. We'll just do it in this part of the blackboard. All right. So we know that this equation reduces to that one, provided we have static field, we have weak field, and we have small velocities. That's what we done yesterday. Okay. We also know what we learned from here is that actually the GTT component of the metric is simply given by minus 1 plus 2 phi newton over c squared. Okay, so this is what we learned yesterday, just comparing the two equations. Well, very good. So then, can we guess what this equation has to be so that this equation in the appropriate limit reduces to that equation here? Okay, can we just guess what it is? So we see, well, phi newton, the information about the phi newton is precisely captured by the component GTT of the metric. Okay, so then what we actually, we can write this Newton's equation, this one here. So we can write this one here. So nabla square phi newton equals to 4 pi g rho. So this better be the static weak field limit of our Einstein equations, right? So you want this one in Newtonian limit. But we know that phi newton is simply captured by the metric GTT. Okay, so what it means is that I can write this, but there's this important 2 here, right? So it's minus, well, there's a constant 1, which doesn't make, you know, any difference because I am differentiating this one. So minus 1 is not important, but minus 2 phi is important. So the 2 is important. Okay? So we can write this as minus nabla square acting on GTT equals to 4 pi. Okay, now it's 8 pi because of that important 2, g newton. Okay, so now what stands here, rho, is just the energy density. Okay, so now, of course, Newton, well, Einstein knew that the energy density is simply a component, 0, 0, tt component of the energy momentum tensor. Okay, so energy momentum tensor was known already in Maxwell time, right? So people studied stresses and whatever. So people knew what t mu nu for the electromagnetic field is already in the 19th century. So certainly with special relativity, people knew many more t mu nus. So then, you know, what this guy is really is TTT, okay, which is the just the zero component of the energy momentum tensor. Okay, but this looks like a TT component of a tensor equation, right? So, of course, what is very tempting to do is that is to replace this TTT with the full T mu nu. Okay, so we go here, so we will have 8 pi g T mu nu on the right hand side, and it will be our vector or tensor equation. Okay, and then we better write something on the right hand side, which is also indexed mu and nu. Okay, let's call that something capital G mu nu. Okay, so this is our equation, which we can, you know, guess from here. But what is this capital G mu nu? So this G mu nu, so this capital G mu nu, well, it must be some tensor which is constructed out of the metric, right? But you see that, of course, the tensor, so this G mu nu will depend on the metric. But it better, well, it can depend in principle also on the first derivatives of the metric and on the second derivatives of the metric, as we see here. So we have a second derivative of GTT, so it will be dependent on the second derivatives of the metric. Can we go further? Can we go to the third derivatives of the metric? In principle, we can, but you know that causes lots of problems, similar, you know, to anything. If you start introducing third derivatives into your equations of motion, then you are in trouble. So this is a reasonable assumption. So our tensor g mu nu, which we are looking for, will depend on g, dg, and d squared g. Okay. So then, what you know next is very important, and what Einstein used to basically guess his equations is, well, you know that T mu nu is conserved. Okay, so you know that in special relativity you have a relation d mu T mu nu equals to zero. in special relativity. And that was known in that time. All right. So now, in general relativity, and again, that's, you know, what you learn in, not today, well, maybe today, is that this is not good enough. If you have a gravitational field, if you want, so this is not a tensor equation. You need to replace this. If you have curve metric, you need to replace this with a covariant derivative. So this is what Einstein knew long time before, actually, formulating his equations, that this is the right equation. So you just replace the partial derivative with some new derivative, which includes, you know, I can change my frame to an accelerated frame, and this will still be true. Okay, so this is the covariant derivative, which he knew. Okay, so we have nabla mu t mu n equals to zero. But if I take nabla mu on this equation, I have nabla mu t mu n, so the right-hand side is equal to zero. So then the left-hand side better be equal to zero as well. So this thing implies that nabla mu g mu nu better be zero as well. That's a consistency equation in order to write this. This is a consistency. Okay, but now I can take a different t mu nu. If I take a different t mu nu, well, this thing, well, that different t mu nu will still satisfy this. So this thing better be true for any t mu nu. That means for any metric. So consistency, and I require this to be for any metric. Okay, so then, now the problem is very well posed. So I know what the right-hand side of my field equation is. It must be 8 pi g t mu nu. So now I'm asking, can you find such a g mu nu, which depends on metric, first derivative metric, and second derivative of the metric, in such a way that nabla mu g mu nu equals to zero automatically for any metric? And so then you go to your friend, mathematician, and you ask him, is there such a g mu nu which would satisfy this property? And then Marcel Grossmann will tell you, yes, there is. And it's more or less unique. And it's given by the Einstein tensor. OK, so from here, Marcel Grossmann will tell you that g mu nu is the Einstein tensor. And so this is how Einstein derived his equations. All right, so isn't that beautiful? We have just, you know, in this thing, we just arrived at the full theory of gravitational field. Yes?
Where did you get the d mu t mu v?
This thing here?
Yeah.
OK, so this is what was known a long time ago. So this is true for the Maxwell theory if you don't have any sources or whatever. You just take t mu nu for electromagnetism. And you have d mu t mu nu equal to zero, which means that there will be a conserved charge or something like that. That's correct. Maybe correct. But anyway, so then, you know, what is a little bit non-trivial is that you want this to be true not only in special inertial frames, but also in the accelerated frame or rotating frame or whatever. And so then what you have to do is that you have to replace this partial derivative with something new, which we'll discuss today, and it's a covariant derivative. So it's like a partial. So this thing reduces to the partial derivative if you are in inertial frame. Okay, but if you are not, this is more general. So then, you know, this is something which is a conservation of the energy momentum tensor, and it was known that, you know, all the energy momentum tensors actually satisfy this. Okay, so then, you know, but what you have to require now is that, you know, this will be true for any t mu nu, so for any metric. So I require that nabla mu g mu nu has to be zero for any metric. And there's only one such g mu nu, basically, which satisfies that. And it's the g mu nu, which is given by a special tensor called Einstein tensor. We will see it next week. Don't worry what it is. Okay? So, but this is how you derive the Einstein equations by hand waving. All right. Questions? Isn't this beautiful? All right. So that was the beautiful part. Now the painful part. So we are aiming to know what this G mu is and why it is unique and why Marcel Grossmann could tell Emilian Einstein, this is the G mu you are looking for. Okay. So by the way, you know, precisely this physical way of thinking was precisely what Einstein did when he formulated his equations. Unfortunately, or fortunately for him, he actually gave a seminar to Hilbert a couple of months, you know, before he actually could finish this task. And he explained Hilbert what he's trying to do. He explained him, I am trying to find equations which, you know, have these properties or whatever. And of course, Hilbert, being the greatest mathematician of his time, then immediately wrote down the answer before Einstein. And so he had basically the Einstein equations much earlier than Einstein did. Okay? Because he didn't care about physics, he just knew mass. Right? And that's why, you know, the action for gravity is called Einstein-Hilbert action, because Hilbert was the first one to derive it. All right. I have no one. I'm not sure. I don't know. but I think he published first, but then he actually recognizes that, you know, it was just really because the Einstein gave the seminar and just.
Einstein must have been really pissed off.
Sorry?
Einstein must have been like furious.
No. All right, chapter 3. We need to learn about the differential geometry. So let's call it geometric tools. And then I think I'll be able to give you just the definition of the manifold. So part A will be manifolds. And so I'll be doing the physics way. So if you have taken any course in differential geometry in the math department, so please be nice to me. I'll be just doing really, really crazy things from a mathematical point of view. But anyway, so manifold, what it is, for example, this thing here. So I can have some holes or whatever in the manifold. But manifold, for us, what it will be is that, of course, it will consist of some points. So I will have a point on the manifold P here. And then the crucial thing for the manifold is that each point P will belong to some neighborhood around that point P. And in that neighborhood, the manifold looks like R to the n. So like a vector space, real number to the n. And then you say that the manifold is n-dimensional manifold. Okay. So now that's not everything what you require. So each piece around that point, around each point, it looks like R to the n. That's one thing. Second thing is that it is nice and smooth and differentiable. So I can actually, you know, okay, and smooth.
So it is some sort of open manifold.
Open manifold. I don't consider, let's not talk about this manifolds, these boundaries. Let's just have boundaries. Yeah, you can, okay, whatever. You can do whatever you want, right? And boundaries are important to calculate the actions and stuff like that. But let's just talk about the simplest case here without boundaries. All right, so you require that the manifold is basically nice and smooth, differentiable, and it looks locally like just a space R to the n. But this will be only locally. So around each point, you can find this R to the n space, but globally, this may not be true. So locally looks like R to the n, but not globally. But not globally. And obviously, you know. So what it also means is that, you know, if I want to describe manifold with some coordinate system, I may not be able to cover the whole manifold with one coordinate system, as we have seen in our case, but I may need several coordinate systems to describe the manifold. Okay, so let me just give you a definition, and it's a painful definition, so let's do it. But as I said, this is not a mathematical definition, so please be nice to me. Yes. Okay, so n-dimensional manifold n dimensional manifold M. So you have manifold M in n dimensional manifold is a set of points as hell mean set of points, but anyway, together with a collection of the neighborhoods together with a collection of subsets O alpha, which satisfy the following three properties. So, first property is that each point in the manifold belongs to one of these subsets. So each P on the manifold lies in at least one O alpha. So in other words, you know, the subsets O alpha, they cover the whole manifold. I can only have a point which wouldn't belong to some of these subsets. So that means that O alpha cover M. Okay. Very good. So the second point is that the manifold really looks like R to the N, and to make sure that this is true, there will be the corresponding map from the manifold to R to the N. Okay, so now for each alpha, there is 1 to 1. Okay, why not? Onto whatever that means. Onto. Map psi alpha, which maps the region O alpha to a subregion open set U alpha, which is an open set of R to the N, where U alpha, which is an open set. Or subset of R to the N. Okay, so that's the second property. And it's basically telling you, you know, I can map really the neighborhood of each point to some region in R to the N. Okay. And finally, the third property is telling you about the smoothness of the manifold. We will have a differential manifold. So finally, third point is that if any two sets of O alpha and O beta overlap, O beta overlap. That means O alpha O beta is non-trivial. Then the maps, basically from one overlap, well, from one R to the N to the other R to the N of the overlap is C infinity map. So then the map which is now psi alpha to minus one composed with psi beta is infinitely differentiable. So C infinity. So that's the three points of the definition which I will assume. And so let's just draw a picture. What they mean is, of course, obvious. So of course, the third property is only required if you want a differentiable manifold, which we, of course, want. All right, so let's plot a picture. So this is our manifold. Let me just draw one hole here. So then let's take any point P on the manifold. Then the statement is, in the first case, there must be this point P must lie in some neighborhood O alpha. So there must be a neighborhood of this point P, which we call O alpha, so that P belongs to this neighborhood O alpha. Okay, so this must be true. Okay, so now point number two is telling you, well, now for each O alpha, I will have a corresponding map which maps this region on the manifold to a subregion of the R to the n space. Okay, so there is an R to the n space here. This is an R to the n space, which is our favorite multidimensional real space. And there's a corresponding map, which maps, let's call it psi alpha, which maps this O alpha region into subregion of R to the n. So that's our U alpha, and this is the image of the point P. So this would be psi of P. I of P is this point here, and then there's some open region U alpha where I map this thing into the R to the n. So that's the point number two. So I can always do this for any point P. So finally, the fun starts if you have actually overlapping regions. So now your point P does not only belong to the region O alpha, but it also belongs to a region O beta. So then, point P also belongs to a region O beta. Of course, the region O beta has associated with it the corresponding map psi beta, which maps to the R to the n. So there'll be another R to the n, and the corresponding map psi beta, which maps this O beta into U beta, and this will be the psi beta of P. So this is psi alpha of P, and this is psi beta of P. Okay, so that's certainly true by the point two. And then, of course, I have this overlap of the two regions, which is this one here. That will correspond to some overlap, well, to some region here. And some region here. Okay, that's the overlap of the two. And then I consider a map between this thing here to that thing here. So over this region to that region. And so this map is just, I have to go from here to there, just with the help of psi beta minus 1, psi beta minus 1. And then I compose that, just going from here to there, this psi alpha. So that's my map, which goes from here to there. OK? But if you look at that map simply goes from a space R to the n to another space R to the n. So it doesn't, it's not a manifold map. It doesn't deal with manifolds. It just deals with functions which go from n variables to n variables. Okay, so this is just a normal map as you know it from multidimensional calculus. Okay, and so then you know what it means that this thing, this function from n functions to n functions is smooth and nice. So you require that this map is infinitely differentiable in the sense of the multidimensional calculus. And so that you know, that's precisely what you require in order to have differential manifold. But see, the beauty of this construction is really that, you know, you basically eliminate the manifold from the picture completely, right? You talk about the manifold, but you talk about it not, you know, being on that manifold, but rather talking about the corresponding R to the n space or the corresponding other R to the n space. So you always have, you know, you will always describe properties of the manifolds, like, you know, in terms of going from one R to the n space to another R to the n space, or from something which you already know from the multidimensional calculus. Okay? So that's the formal definition. This is, you know, the meaning of the definition. Some terminology. So these psi alpha maps are called, well, so psi alpha are called charts in mathematics, and they are called coordinate systems in physics. Coordinate systems in physics. So in other words, in this R to the n, you would say I have coordinates x. And in this R to the n, I would say I have a coordinate x prime, and they are related by some coordinate transformation. Okay, so these are charts. Yes?
The image of that, right?
Sorry?
Because I think it is just the image of psi, which is a chart, because psi is I think that the chart is the.
No, the coordinate system lives here, right, in R to the n.
Yeah, that's why I say it is the image.
Yeah. Okay. No, but this is, you know, every physicist will tell you, well, this is just a coordinate system, right? Okay? So the collection of these things, you know that if you have lots of charts, you have a big book which is called Atlas. Okay? So the, you know, this thing, the collection of charge, collection is called Atlas. Did I forget anything? Okay, so the last thing which I wanted to mention here, well, okay, few things. So of course, trivial examples of a manifold. One example is just a plane. That will be a manifold. Another example will be a surface of the sphere. Okay, so the sphere is a manifold. Another example of a manifold is a torus. Okay, so we have examples like examples, for example, a sphere or a torus. I have a stupid example. Do you think this is a manifold? Light cone, is it a manifold? Because?
It is not.
Because there's a problem here. So this is not a manifold. Okay, so that's a stupid example. What about this thing here, string theory? You have a brain and you have a patch string. Is it a manifold? Of course, this is not a manifold because the dimensionality is off, right? But plane itself is a manifold, and string itself will be a manifold. But this is not a manifold. Okay, very good. So now, finally, you know, sometimes people think about manifolds as simply objects which are embedded in some higher dimensional space. So for example, this thing, well, not really, would be a manifold if it were nice and smooth. And it will be embedded in the three-dimensional space, and I could imagine this object, you know, here in this three-dimensional space. It's always possible to do that if you go to sufficiently high dimension. So I don't know what the exact dimension is, probably twice the dimension of the manifold or something like that. This is called embedding theorems. If you've seen the movie The Beautiful Mind, so he's the guy who actually, you know, constructed these embedding theorems. And he showed that indeed every manifold can be embedded into some higher dimensional space, and you can understand it as an object in this higher dimensional space. The truth is that this is not really useful. So it's better to think about the manifold through these R to the n charts without thinking about the manifold to be a physical object embedded in some higher dimensional space. Okay? So it's better to think about it through this definition rather than actually thinking about an object floating somewhere. Okay?
You're doing quotients. For quotients?
For?
for Gaussians.
Gaussians?
Gaussians.
Oh, Gaussians, I see.
Then you...
Okay, nevertheless, that will not prevent us from embedding, for example, the Einstein-Rosen bridge into the 3D space to see how the geometry of a wormhole looks like. So we will see some examples of embeddings in high-dimensional space, but it's not always useful. Okay, so let me stop here. We continue today at 3:45.